Chapter 1. The Journey Downwards. Of the Silence of the Dead. "Where are you taking me?" Joseph asked Kedema, one of the old man's sons, as they were setting up the sleeping huts in the rolling, moonlit lowland at the foot of the mountains called Fruitlands. Kedema looked him up and down. "Thou art a good one," said he, and shook his head in token that he did not mean good at all, but various other things, such as pert, or queer, or simple. "Where are we taking thee?" "But are we taking thee anywhither?" "No, not at all. Thou art by chance with us, because our father hath purchased thee from harsh masters, and thou goest with us whitherever we go. But taking thee, that cannot be called."
"No? Then not," responded Joseph. "I only meant, whither doth God lead me, in that I go with you?"
"Thou art and remainest a funny fellow," countered the Maonite, "and thou hast a way of putting thyself in the center of things, till one knoweth not whether to wonder or be put out. Thinkest thou, thou come hither, that we are a-journeying in order that thou mayest arrive somewhither where thy God will have thee to come?"
"Not that do I think," Joseph replied.
"For I know that you, my masters, journey whither you will, and on your own affairs, and of a certainty no question of mine meaneth any wrong to your dignity or power. But lo, the world hath many centres, one for each created being, and about each one it lieth in its own circle. Thou standest but half an ell from me, yet about thee lieth a universe whose centre I am not, but thou art. Therefore both are true, according as one speaketh from thy center or from mine, and I, on the other hand, stand in the center of mine. For our universes are not far from each other, so that they do not touch. Rather hath God pushed them and interwoven them deep into each other, so that you Ishmaelites do indeed journey quite independently and according to your own ends, whether you will, but besides that, you are the means and tool in our interwovenness, that I arrive at my goal. Therefore I ask whither you are leading me."
"Well, well," said Kedema, and kept looking him up and down, his face turned away from the peg he was driving. "All that thou thinkest out, and thy tongue runs on like a lizard's tongue. I will tell the old man, my father, how thou, son of a dog as thou art, takest leave to riddle and stick thy nose into such high wisdom as that thou hast a universe to thyself, and we are destined for thy guardians. Take care, I'll tell him."
"Do so," responded Joseph. "It will do no harm. It will make thy father careful not to sell me too cheap to the first comer, if he thinketh of making trade with me."
"Are we chattering here?" asked Kedema, "or are we setting up a hut?" And he motioned him to lend a hand. But as they worked, he said, "Thou askest too much when thou wilt know from me whither we journey. I would have naught against telling thee if I knew. But it is the old man my father's business. He keepeth all in his own head how it will go, and afterwards we see how it cometh to pass. So much is clear that we keep on as the shepherds thy harsh masters counseled us, and go not into the interior, but are bound toward the level shore. There shall we travel day by day, and come into the land of the Philistines, the cities of the seafaring traders and the pirate strongholds. Perhaps thou wilt be sold there somewhere to the galleys."
"That would I not have," said Joseph.
"No use to wish. All will be as the old man hath thought. And whither we journey at the end, that he himself perhaps knoweth not. But he would like us to think that he knoweth all quite precisely beforehand. And so we all act as though we thought so, Epher, Mibsam, Kedar, and I. I tell thee this because we happen to be setting up the huts here together. Otherwise I have no reason to say it to thee. I could wish the old man would not exchange thee too soon for purple and cedar oil, but that thou wouldst remain here with us for a spell, that one might hear more from thee about the universes of men and their interwovenness."
"As thou wilt," answered Joseph. "You are my masters, and have bought me for 20 silver pieces, including my tongue and my wits. They are at your service. And to that about the universe of the individual, I can add something about God's not quite flawless wonder working with numbers, so that man must improve his calculations. And further, about the pendulum, the year of the dog star, and the renewal of life? But not now, Kedema said. The huts must absolutely be set up now, for the old man my father is tired, and so am I. I fear that I could not follow thy tongue any more for today. Art thou still ailing from thy fast? And are thy limbs still sore where thou wast bound with cords?
Scarcely at all, responded Joseph. After all, it was only 3 days that I spent in the pit, and your oil with which I might anoint myself has done my limbs great good. I am now whole, and nothing detracteth from the value and usefulness of thy slave.
He had, in fact, had opportunity to cleanse and anoint himself, had received from his master's a loincloth, and for cooler hours a rumpled white hooded cape, such as the thick-lipped camel boy wore. Probably the expression, to feel as one new-born, may have fitted him more precisely than it has any human being since the creation of the world. For had he not actually been born again? It was a deep cleavage and abyss that divided his present from his past. It was the grave. Since he had died young, his vital forces reassembled themselves quickly and easily beyond it. But that did not prevent him from distinguishing sharply between his present existence and that earlier one which had ended in the grave, nor from considering himself not the old Joseph, but a new one. If to be dead and perished means to be quite inseparably bound to a state which permits no looking back, no gesture, no smallest resumption of relations with his previous life, if it means to be vanished speechless from that former life without leave or thinkable possibility of breaking the silence with any whatsoever sign, then Joseph was dead. And the oil with which he might anoint himself after cleansing from the dust of the grave had been no other than that which one gives the dead into the grave for his anointing in another life. I stress this point, for it seems to me urgent to defend Joseph now and later from a reproach which has often historically been leveled against him. For certainly a reproach lies in the query, why, after escaping from the pit, had he not bent all his strength to get in touch with Jacob in his pitiable state, to let him know that he still lived? The opportunity must early have presented itself. Yes, as time passed, it would surely have been more and more possible for the son to send to that father, in his error, some word of the truth. Proportionally strange, even offensive, must it seem, that he did nothing of the kind. But the reproach confuses the outwardly with the inwardly possible, and leaves out of consideration the 3 black days which preceded the rising of Joseph. They had driven him, amid severest anguish, to an insight into the deadly error of his former life, and to a renunciation of it. They had taught him to accept his brother's conviction of his death. His resolve and purpose not to betray their belief was the firmer, because it was not voluntary, but as involuntary and logically necessary as the silence of the dead. A dead man is silent about his love, not out of lovelessness, but necessity. And not in cruel wise was Joseph silent to his father. Indeed, it became very hard on him, and the longer it lasted, the harder it grew. That we may believe. Not easier than on the dead lies the earth which covers him. Pity for the old man, who he well knew had loved him more than himself, whom he too loved with grateful, natural love, and together with whom he had brought himself down to the grave, tempted him sore, and would have made him glad to act contrary to his better sense. But there is something strange about a pain felt by others for our own fate. Our sympathy with it is of a peculiar kind, distinctly harder and colder than that we feel with a stranger's sorrow. Joseph had passed through frightfulness. He had received cruel instruction, and it eased for him his compassion for Jacob. Yes, the consciousness of their common burden made his father's woe seem somehow in the nature of things. His bond to death prevented him from cancelling the bloody sign which the other must have received. Jacob, he knew, could not fail to take the blood of the kid for his son's blood, and that this must be so worked upon Joseph until it practically obliterated the distinction between "this is my blood" and "this represents my blood." Jacob held him for dead, and since he did so irrevocably, unalterably, then was Joseph dead, or was he not? He was. The proof lay in the compulsion to keep silence to the father. The kingdom of the dead received him, or rather, would receive him, for he soon learned that he was still on the way thither, being led in that direction by the Midianites who had bought him. To the Master. "Thou art to come to the Master," a boy named Baal-Mahar said one evening to Joseph, as the latter was busy baking pancakes on hot stones. They were now some days distant from Mount Kirmel, having come along the sandy shore close to the open sea. Joseph had asserted that he made uncommonly good pancakes, and actually, by God's help, he succeeded in making excellent ones, though he had never made or been asked to make them before. They had camped at sunset at the foot of the rushy and grassy line of dunes which had for days monotonously accompanied their course on the land side. It had been very hot. Now mildness descended from a paling sky. The beach extended, violet-hued. The retreating sea rustled silkily, sending broad, shallow waves to the wet margin of the shore, where they were gilded with red-gold splendor by the scarlet rays of the parting sun. The camels rested beside their pegs. Not far from the shore, a clumsy freight boat, worked by two men and seemingly laden with wood, was being towed southwards by a sailing ship propelled by oars. The sailboat had a short mast and a long yard, many cables, and an animal's head on the prow high above the water. "To the Master," repeated the camel boy. "He summons thee through my mouth. He is sitting on the mat in his tent, and he says, thou art to come before him. I was passing, and he called me by my name, Baal-Mahar, and spake, send to me him lately bought, that son of the swamps, that come hither out of the depths. I would question him." "Aha," thought Joseph. "Kedema hath told him about the universes. That is very well." "Yes," said he. "He expressed himself thus, because he knew not how otherwise to make thee comprehend whom he meant. He must speak to thee, my good fellow, according to thy understanding." "Indeed," retorted the other. "What else should he have said? For wanting to see me, he would say, send to me Baal-Mahar, for that is my name. But with thee it is harder, for to thee one can but whistle." "I suppose he would see thee always," said Joseph, "though thou art but a scald head. Go now, thanks for thy message." "What thinkest thou?" cried Baal-Mahar. "Thou must come straightway with me, that I bring thee before him. For if thou comest not, I shall suffer." "But first," answered Joseph, "I must just finish this pancake before I go. I will take it with me, that the master may try my excellent baking. Be quiet and wait." And with the slave emitting cries of impatience, he baked the pancake brown, then rose from his squatting posture and said, "I come." Baal-Mahar accompanied him to the old man, who sat contemplatively on his mat in the low entrance of his traveling tent. "To hear is to obey," said Joseph, saluting. The old man, gazing into the fading glow of eve, nodded, and then lifted one of his hands from his lap with a sidewise wave in sign that Baal-Mahar should disappear.